degrees with a wind chill of 33. And outside of our studios at Friends Plaza in Urbana, it's 33 degrees. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine.
WILL programming is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2013 lecture series presents Human Beings, What Sets Us Apart? By Lynn Rudder Baker on Friday, March 1st at 4 p.m. at the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. I'm Chris Berube. A lot has been made this week over the sequester, $85 billion in automatic spending cuts that will take effect starting March 1st if there is not some kind of compromise reached in Washington over the federal deficit. But how bad is the sequester going to be? The White House sent out a letter yesterday outlining the ways in which the sequester will hurt each state individually, and Republicans countered saying, really, the cuts aren't going to be that bad. Let's actually talk to someone who's been at the sequester negotiations. Lynn Sweet is the Washington bureau chief and a political columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and she's here to talk to us about the sequester negotiations and how they might impact Illinois. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been following the sequester negotiations closely. What have you seen over the last few days?
Well, there's a deadlock. You could call it gridlock. You could call it an impasse. We're heading towards the Friday deadline, and there's nothing in sight to say that the sequester will not happen. The administration, the Obama administration, is stepping up. It's highlighting of what government services may be reduced or curtailed by bringing out cabinet members to talk about what the hits may mean. They've been doing a lot of talking about what an impact may be in an individual state. And in Illinois, by the way, one of the biggest concerns I think people may have sooner than later, beginning in April, would be a curtailing of or a delay in air service throughout the airports in Illinois because you would have fewer controllers. So part of the administration's strategy to pressure Republicans is to highlight some of the cuts that will kick in sooner. The whole question of when the cuts actually take place is a good one, by the way, because not everything will happen right away. These cuts could be staggered. So it could take maybe in some cases years to feel an impact. But by highlighting what will happen sooner, the administration hopes to put more pressure on Republicans.
You mentioned the possibility that there are going to be travel delays, you know, at O'Hare and Midway Airport in Chicago. What are the other specific impacts to Illinois that the administration has been highlighting?
Well, you have airports in Springfield, Decatur, all over the state, smaller airports that serve general aviation, which is usually thought of as private planes. There are towers throughout the state that have controllers in them. So if there are fewer controllers, and because safety is a top priority, it means that the flights will be separated more there in order to make sure that there's enough space between planes. It means everything goes slower at an airport. So you could have a delay throughout the system in Illinois. No airport will actually be closed. In case that's what you think, it just means there will be delays. Now, if you go to an airport that is busy, if you have fewer Transportation Security Administration authority screeners, well, the lines may be longer. So you may have to build in time. Another thing is if you fly from Champaign-Urbana or Springfield, Decatur, Peoria to Chicago or St. Louis, the big regional areas in Illinois, to get connecting flights, you may have to build in more time even to make sure you don't miss your connecting flight. So I would think for air travelers, that may be something that kicks in sooner than later.
Another cut that was highlighted yesterday that actually pertains to Illinois is specifically about work-study programs for college students. Could you tell me how that's going to affect the state and specifically people here at the University of Illinois?
Well, I don't know specifics about every university in Illinois, but in general, there will be fewer work-study slots or the money. I don't want to use the word slots per se, but the administration said that there will be fewer students who will be helped by the program, which is a terrific program for so many students, which helps them have jobs at the universities they attend. You know, less money less assistance.
So you mentioned that these cuts might actually be kind of staggered in the way that they roll out. How's that going to work exactly? Does that make it more or less likely that they're going to take action before the March 1st deadline, do you think?
Nothing is a surprise to the lawmakers. We've known for more than a year about the cuts that will have to be in place across the board. Now, the Republicans are arguing that one place where they might give is to allow cabinet secretaries more discretion so they could juggle the money they have. You know, you have less money, but you could decide more how to spend it so you don't have automatic cuts in every part of your budget. So if we go back to the airport situation, for example, air traffic controllers' payroll is a big, big chunk of the Department of Transportation's payroll. So if you give the agency the discretion to maybe not spend it on something else but keep but don't furlough any air controllers, or maybe that would be a way to accommodate the flying public. But right now, there's no choice. Everything's automatic. And let me explain that for a moment, because listeners might want to know. Who came up with, why is this? Well, what a crazy idea to have forced automatic across-the-board spending cut without any thought to it. Well, this was the solution that the White House and Congress came up with in 2011, a solution considered so draconian that, of course, everybody would come to their senses and make deals on spending and revenue. That hasn't happened.
It seems like we've had a fiscal crisis every couple of months in Washington for the last few months, and the Republicans have backed down on the last two by the sounds of it. Does that make it kind of less likely that they're going to give a lot of ground on the sequester fight?
Well, I think I may respectfully disagree with how you put it, because there was ground that Republicans got in the last episode of this drama, which we could call the fiscal cliff. And the Republicans were able to, the one of the issues that President Obama campaigned on was letting taxes, federal income taxes, rise on people who made more than $250,000. Under Republican pressure, Obama and Democrats let that go to $400,000 income. So Republicans got that and some other items dealing with taxation in that fiscal cliff package that they wanted. So there were elements of a compromise in that. What's maybe different now? Well, the Republicans' ratings are lower and the president's ratings are higher, so the Obama team may feel more emboldened than they did last time. I think we will pass the Friday deadline because, as a matter of practicality, we passed the fiscal cliff deadline by a few days, and impact on the economy was minor. Congress loves deadlines. It's sometimes the only way they could get things done. I wouldn't expect anything today, tomorrow, the days leading up to Friday to necessarily break the deadlock.
So we may pass the sequester deadline, but it's not necessarily the end of the world for the economy.
So far, the market has not responded negatively. There's no nosedive. I think if something were to happen between the time we're talking and Friday, that also could impact. That could have as big an impact as anything on how Republicans and Democrats see it. President Obama is in Virginia on Tuesday trying to highlight the cuts on the defense spending and military personnel. One thing in Illinois, we have big bases in Scott Air Force Base downstate and up in Lake County, Illinois. We have the Great Lakes Naval Station. In all, there are about 14,000 civilian Defense Department employees in Illinois who will have some impact on them, furloughs or some curtailment. There are improvements in money that flows to Scott that would be curtailed. There are, if you wanted, like a real basic example, there are several buildings up at Great Lakes that are scheduled to be demolished this year, and plans for that would be on hold. So you have those local businesses, I'm sure, that were contracted to help do that, probably would have people who they employ to do the work, so you could see that would have an impact if that contract isn't replaced with other work. So the administration is hoping, by dramatizing what happens in each day, to put pressure on congressmen to come to a deal.
Well, Lynn Sweet, thank you so much for bringing some illumination to this for us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House at Green and Lincoln, 3 blocks from the Engineering Quad. Hendrick House rooms are large, carpeted, and air-conditioned with semi-private baths. Meals are served in its Gold LEED certified dining area. More information is available at hendrickhouse.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 26th of February, 2013. It's the birthday of the man who said, "To love another person is to see the face of God," the French novelist Victor Hugo, born in Besançon, France, 1802. He wrote The Hunchback of Notre Dame when he was in his 20s, became famous and wealthy. He used his fame to advocate for political causes, namely to denounce the regime of Napoleon III and encourage the French to rise up and revolt. So, Napoleon III declared Victor Hugo an enemy of the state, and Hugo fled the country in disguise, went to Brussels, then spent 20 years in exile on the island of Guernsey in the English Channel, where he wrote, standing up at a pulpit, looking out across the water, wrote 20 pages of prose a day, wrote his masterpiece, Les Miserables, published in 1865, about a poor Parisian man who steals a loaf of bread, spends 19 years in jail for it, afterward becomes a successful businessman, mayor of a small town, and then is imprisoned once again for a minor crime in his distant past. The playwright Christopher Marlowe, baptized in Canterbury, England, on this date, 1564, a very gifted boy, son of a shoemaker, went to Cambridge on a scholarship, and it is believed he became a spy for Queen Elizabeth I, posing as a Catholic to gather intelligence on any plots against the Protestant queen. Even less is known about Marlowe than about Shakespeare, but his plays reveal a man who was cynical about religion and politics, who was most likely a homosexual and an atheist in a time when it was very dangerous to be either one, let alone both. But he was a brilliant poet and dramatist, worked in blank verse, inspired Shakespeare to do the same. Before he was stabbed to death in a tavern at the age of 29, he wrote Tamburlaine the Great, Dr. Faustus, The Jew of Malta,